Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Canada's boreal wetlands are an important habitat for migrating ducks and other birds. Kevin Smith of Ducks Unlimited is using remote sensing technology to map these potholes and muskegs across the north. And graduate student Dave Roth discusses his work to find biological controls for tent caterpillars that feed on the boreal's aspen stands. And if you're wondering where your next cool job might come from, check out this new book by Claudia Sammer. It features 40 cool companies in Edmonton and Calgary that lead the way in new technologies. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. One quarter of the world's remaining intact boreal forest lies in Canada, and so do one third of the world's wetlands. Ducks Unlimited Canada has embarked on an ambitious initiative to save our boreal wetlands because of their importance to waterfowl and other migratory birds. Part of this initiative includes mapping and cataloging the thousands of lakes, potholes, and fens across the north. Kevin Smith is a remote sensing specialist with Ducks Unlimited in California, and he recently traveled from Sacramento to meet with his colleagues in Alberta who are working on the boreal project.
In Sacramento Ducks Unlimited offices, we have a 15-year history of mapping using satellites across the boreal region from Alaska all the way through western Canada. We've mapped about 250 million acres of wetland and upland habitat all across that region, and so we're using that expertise and technology to help the Western Boreal Program of Ducks Unlimited, based here in Edmonton, Alberta, to provide those information layers to them to use in their conservation management data sets. So,
is that something that this whole western region hasn't been mapped before?
Yeah, there's the boreal region has varying data sets in terms of information that's available for use with conservation and or other types of data. And so what we're trying to do is help provide some of the inventory, both on what the basic earth cover is and wetlands are, but also the water bird and water chemistry and some of the processes that occur in the boreal. So we're just trying to bridge that information gap a little bit.
How large is this area that you have to map?
Well, in terms of Canada itself, when you're talking about wetlands, it's about a third of the world's wetlands. And what we're trying to map is the northern parts of Canada from basically the agricultural regions in the south all the way north. So we're looking at very, very large areas and a lot of diverse cover. So it's a challenging task in itself, but also an exciting one.
How are you going about it? What technologies are you using?
Well, because it's such a large area, we use satellite-based remote sensing to give us kind of the information that we can use to process and classify. So we take that data and then we classify it into different earth cover types and provide that information.
So is that all done from satellite or do you have to fly over the area?
So there's two components of the program. One is a field season to get the person that's classifying the scene and also some vegetation specialists and ecologists. We all fly out in helicopters to ground truth certain portions of that project area, and then we extrapolate those sampling sites out to the entire project.
Are you having to develop new technology or new models to deal with this?
Yeah, historically there have been a number of different processes that have been used to classify data, and we've been working on developing several new ones to better use the information available and to provide enhanced data sets that in terms of wetlands and other disturbed areas, change detection, things like that. We've been updating the procedures and protocols and using new technology and new classification programs to go from where the computer kind of does it all itself to kind of a more holistic approach of looking at all the data available and using more of a intuitive what the human eye would see instead of a computer deciding, you know, what that area should be. So it's a more interactive process.
You've been at this for a little while then. What are some of the things that you're finding out?
We're finding that it's been very difficult to map wetlands, for instance.
Why is that?
Well, there are a variety of different kinds, and they change over time, and they have all kinds of different cover types, and they occur throughout the landscape. And so there's a very wide, if you think in terms of what the satellite sees, there's a very wide range of possibilities of what that could be in terms of what's in the satellite data. So it's been very challenging in the past to map those because of those reasons. So what we've been doing is kind of putting boundaries on what the spectral range of these areas could be, and then classifying those as opposed to just doing the whole image. So we're kind of segmenting the image into regions that are similar, and then processing within that to focus our efforts a lot better.
How does this fit into the other components of the program, the head project, which deals with the hydrology and also the inventory, looking for all the different waterfowl birds that are up in that area?
Well, this information data set is kind of what you would say is the base layer information. So this is what is on the ground all across the project area. So it ties in all of the other data sets and is used in conjunction with them. So for instance, you map the whole area and you have a map of the basin that the water bird surveys are being done at, and the water chemistry information is being collected. But you also have some information on the area around that watershed. So how might it be impacted by a road? What are the nutrients that are going into that basin? What explains that? What are the wetland habitats around that? Things like that.
Why is this so important?
This is really ties into providing information in terms of conservation management across the boreal. There are a lot of challenges to the boreal region, from agriculture to industry, and so what we're trying to do is to provide information layers so that can be best managed, both with the industrial uses and providing habitat and forest management and things like that can serve as much waterfowl and other species, as well as kind of the ecosystem function of those areas, and allow for the use of industry and recreation, and so that everything works kind of together, as opposed to not planning it and just going out. So it's a more focused effort for conservation.
So you've mentioned ultimate uses being things like helping in forest management. What other sorts of things?
Another aspect of this is we've combined the technology development with the Canadian Wetland Inventory, which Canada is trying to develop a wetland classification for all of Canada, which is a challenging task, being a third of the world's wetlands. But also having the technology to be able to do that's a challenging thing in itself. So we're working with them, and with the Canadian Space Agency and RadarSat and Environment Canada, to provide those information data sets using the same kind of satellite remote sensing data sets. So we're working in conjunction also with national programs that are going on for inventory as well.
What do you like about this?
I like coming to Canada and seeing the diverse landscapes. It's really beautiful, and everywhere from in Manitoba, the glacial lakes that are azure blue, to the bogs and fens around here, to the northern permafrost areas. It's a very diverse landscape, and very fortunate in my job being able to fly around in helicopters and see this and actually get paid to do it. So it's quite a interesting and also challenging in terms of the technology being developed through this program. It's very intellectually challenging as well, so it's both for personal and professional interests as well.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
That was Kevin Smith, a remote sensing specialist with Ducks Unlimited in Sacramento, California. The boreal forest is a mosaic where stands of spruce and pine share the landscape with poplar and birch. While fire is a threat common to all species, it's an insect, the tent caterpillar, that attacks poplar stands, and severe infestations can kill the trees. But even tent caterpillars have enemies, and these are little wasps and flies that parasitize the caterpillars. Dave Roth is a graduate student in biology at the University of Alberta. With the help of funding from the Alberta Conservation Association, he's looking for a way to harness these tiny parasites as a natural biological control in place of chemical spraying.
The forest tent caterpillar is a species that outbreaks every 10 to 12 years, and essentially that means they go from very low population levels to very high population levels, and this can lead to quite severe forest defoliation of aspen primarily. And so our lab works on a variety of aspects of these outbreaks and what drives these cycles. We also work on stuff like predation, parasitism on these forest tent caterpillar, landscape factors, and how all of these affect it. And essentially the reason this is of interest is, like I said, that by causing severe defoliation, it's both not very aesthetically pleasing. So it looks quite awful in some ways. So if you go to Rocky Mountain House, the last 2 or 3 years, you'd see along the highway kilometers and kilometers of defoliation, so that the trees there have no leaves. And in the summer, this doesn't look real nice. And the other is there is economic impact in terms of alpaca and stuff uses aspen trees for various economic interests, and they have a vested interest in our research as well.
The work that you've been doing, the research, has been supported through the Alberta Conservation Association. Now, why would the ACA be interested in tent caterpillars?
Well, my project focuses actually on the parasitoids, which are a species of insects which actually lay eggs in or on these forest tent caterpillar. And the idea is that these parasitoids play a role in suppressing or regulating forest tent caterpillar outbreaks. And so we're more interested in how landscape features such as forest fragmentation affects these parasitoids, and in turn how this may affect the relationship between parasitoid and forest tent caterpillar. And so ACA comes into play here by being interested in the potential to conserve parasitoid diversity, with the idea that if we lose parasitoids or lose the ability of these parasitoids to deal with forest tent caterpillar, we may have higher incidence of forest tent caterpillar outbreak, or outbreaks may last of longer duration, etc. And research by Jens Roll and my professor has found that forests which have been heavily fragmented do tend to have longer outbreaks, and we feel this may be due to this relationship between parasitoids and forest tent caterpillar. And so the ACA would be interested in, from that viewpoint, trying to conserve the diversity of parasitoids in a biological control sense.
So it's a natural control then?
Yes. The idea is there's a large field of biology called, of entomology anyway, on biological control, with the idea is you can control pest species of insects using these insect parasitoids instead of spraying or introducing other predators that may kill off a large number of species. You can introduce parasitoids which have a very close relationship with the species you're interested in controlling, and so it's essentially in some ways a safer method of controlling these outbreak species.
So your specific project, what were you looking at?
My project specifically was focused on how the landscape factors such as, primarily forest fragmentation, how this affects the ability of these parasitoids to respond to forest tent caterpillar. So essentially we were interested in how do parasitism rates differ between forest fragments. So if you have an isolated patch of forest in the middle of an agricultural landscape, how do parasitism rates there differ from large tracts of continuous forest? And the idea being that we felt that parasitoids would be more likely or more able to respond to forest tent caterpillar outbreaks or increases in their host density in these continuous forest landscapes than they would in heavily fragmented forest.
So when you went out to the field to collect your data, what exactly did you do?
Well, essentially, it involved going to these sites and collecting large numbers of forest tent caterpillar, bringing them back to the lab, and we essentially would rear them out in. So we essentially would put your collections would take place in paper bags, and you would essentially rear these caterpillars out, allow them to go through their natural life cycle until such time as they either turned into a healthy moth or a parasitoid emerged. And then once we had this situation where we had the parasitoids emerging, we could classify what species it was, how many we had of them, and compare this between the two landscape factors and see how either the numbers differed or the species composition differed between sites, and this would hopefully give us an idea of exactly what fragmentation was doing to affect this this relationship between parasitoids and host.
Well, tell me a little bit about the parasitoids. Is it just one species, or is it a number of different insects, and what exactly do they do?
Well, parasitoids are a very, very diverse species, or class of insects. So they're found all over the world. Every herbivorous insect has parasitoids which attack it. And in this case, forest-tent caterpillar has quite a number. So there's probably between 6 or 8 parasitoids, possibly more, depending on if it's at a high, if it's at an outbreak level or low density. But essentially, it's a combination of flies and wasps. So in my system, it's primarily flies. There are wasps, but the flies tend to have a larger impact.
And what do they do?
Parasitoids essentially they lay eggs either on the host or on the leaves that the hosts eat. And so one way or another, essentially the egg gets into the host, into the forest tent caterpillar, and the larva of these parasitoids essentially end up eating the host from the inside out. So it's not a real pleasant scenario, but that's how they end up controlling it. And this differs from predation. And a predator simply eats the host and it's killed immediately. Parasitoids, when they lay these eggs, the host can live for 2 or 3 weeks, going about mostly their normal life, obviously while they have this parasitoid growing within them. And then eventually they succumb to having the parasitoid within. The parasitoid emerges and the next generation of parasitoids is there.
What are some of the things that you found out in your work?
Well, first off, we found that not all species respond the same. So it's not... There's different sizes of parasitoids, different species, different taxons. So there's wasps and flies. And essentially, we found that they don't all respond exactly the same, which is the first thing. And secondly, surprisingly, we found that several species actually had higher parasitism rates in a fragment than they did in continuous forest. And this was unexpected, as we felt that parasitoids would have an easier time responding to forest tent caterpillar in this continuous landscape than they would in forest fragments. But we actually found for 2 or 3 species that parasitism rates were higher in the fragment, and we feel this may be a result of the fact that some research has shown that certain insect species are less likely to cross what are called patch boundaries. So this would be the area between forest and, say, agricultural landscape, that boundary between the two landscape types. And essentially, if this is the case, if there's parasitoids within a fragment, they may tend to essentially bounce around within a fragment and essentially spend more time per unit area searching for hosts, and this could lead to an elevated parasitism rate within fragments.
So they really don't like to fly across an open field?
Well, that's up for debate. There is some research that suggests that, and we feel Jens Rohn, my prof, has found that this really depends on the size of the parasitoid. So there are some very small flies, and these, you know, will travel only a distance of 100 meters through an open landscape, so not very far. So if you have a patch that's very isolated, these parasitoids will have a hard time getting there. Some of the larger parasitoids, larger flies, have no problem and will travel 800 to 1500 meters. And so essentially the reason these parasitoids respond differently to fragmentation is they respond differently to the scale of fragmentation, in the sense that some species aren't really affected by a distance of 500 meters, whereas some are. And so this can have the species will respond differently depending on how isolated some of the patches are and factors such as that.
Well, you're just writing up your stuff now. What conclusions are you drawing?
Well, that's the tricky part. Unfortunately, the project, although it went fairly well, we had weather played a big part in it, and we had a really hard time getting forest tent caterpillars. So we had a hard time finding them, essentially, after we found sites. So initially, numbers were much lower than we had, and this kind of limited our ability to really draw strong conclusions. But we have managed to find a year with one of Jens's postdocs who did a similar experiment in the same site. So we were able to compile 3 years worth of data total. And what we're finding essentially is what I said before, that primarily for some of these species are having higher parasitism rates in fragments. And we're going to combine this with some research actually showing how isolation distance played a role. So we also found that although some of these species had higher parasitism rates in a fragment, interestingly, there didn't appear to be a relationship between the actual distance the patch was isolated from continuous forest.
Where do you go from here?
Oh, that's a tough call, I guess. There's a lot of research that needs to be done in this area. I think with these cyclic species that have outbreaks of kind of 10 years, it's really important to have more long-scale studies. So mine was essentially a 3-year project, which is about as much as you can do for a master's. But it would be really beneficial if a project such as this could be carried on. So that would be one area, simply carry on the same project. Or more research just needs to be done in terms of really getting at this mechanism of what it is about forest fragmentation that's affecting the outbreaks of Forest Town caterpillar.
Thank you very much, Dave.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Dave Roth, a graduate student in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. His research is supported by the Alberta Conservation Association's Grants and Biodiversity Program. A new book in the stores is called Cool Companies. Set in a magazine format, it profiles 40 companies in Edmonton and Calgary that are leaders in innovation. Cool Companies is the brainchild of Claudia Sammer, a physics graduate turned marketer and publisher. And I asked her about the market for her book.
The book is also a book about cool opportunities. The information in the book has been structured in a way to help people find opportunities for their career, for entrepreneurs, for business development, scientific research, and even investment. So who we're trying to reach are people looking for cool opportunities for a new career, for ideas to start a new company, or entrepreneurs that have a company and want to find ideas from other industries that they can transplant into their industry, and people looking for investment, because there's companies in here that are publicly traded and private companies.
Where did the idea come from to do this?
Well, there's really three reasons why I went about creating the book. The first is that companies that are innovation leaders are hard to find. Most people can only name you about two or three companies. So the book is really a shortcut and saves you lots of time and effort. The second reason is that the information in the Cool Companies book is not found anywhere else, not even on the internet. I'm the one that interviewed the CEOs and senior management in each company and asked them what makes them cool, what kind of positions do you have available for next year, what's your revenue structure so we can understand how they make money, what kind of cool technology do you use, and even if they have a foosball table. Of course, having all these profiles together also makes it really easy to compare companies. And lastly, the third reason I put the book together is I've met lots of people that are looking for a new job or a new career, an idea to start a business or a company to invest in. And so often it's chance that plays a big role in helping them find what they want. Like they meet someone on an airplane, they end up working for them or hiring them, or they hear a stock tip in an elevator and they research the company and find out it's a winner. I wanted to increase people's chances of finding the kind of high-quality opportunities that they're looking for. And the book gives them a shortcut to networking to do that.
Were you looking for a job yourself?
I think I've had enough of working for other people. It took me a long time to find a company idea that I wanted to do. And every time that I have been looking for work, I was on the marketing side of new product development in many different companies. Every time I would look for a job, I would always try to find people or companies doing really cool things, because those places are really exciting to work at. And later, when I was looking for an idea to start a company, I wanted to work with companies that were also forward-thinking and doing really neat stuff.
What I think is really cool about your Cool Companies book is it's not actually, you're referring to it as a book, but it's not really a book. It's in a magazine format. Why did you choose that format as opposed to a book or something that has little squirrely things that goes around the edge to bind it together?
Well, I guess the book is kind of as innovative as the companies in it. We did a lot of testing with the book. I wanted to make sure that it always had actionable information that people could really do something with. And the magazine idea, the format, really worked well with our readers, because they could quickly find things that they wanted. And the other thing that made it interesting, being a half book, half magazine, is for the bookstores, you can find the Cool Companies book on magazine shelves just as much as finding them on bookshelves. So it's nice to have that flexibility.
The actual publishing of it, this is your first venture into the publishing arena. How did you even go about figuring out how to do everything?
Well, I use the same approach I have been using for lots of new product development, because it's always served me well. The first is I start out with a product idea that offers really unique and superior customer value. And then you make a prototype. And then I basically tested it on everyone I could find. I think I've interviewed at least a couple hundred people in developing the book that would be target audience kind of people, and asked them what they thought of the prototype, and with every piece of feedback, I improved the book. Product testing has really paid off. People really love the book, and it's been selling really well, and I'm really glad I approached it that way.
You've got 40 different companies in the Cool Companies book. Give me a couple of examples, because you've had to go and interview all of these different people.
Microline was an interesting company. They're here in Edmonton. They are one of the largest independent MIMS manufacturers in the world, so they make very tiny devices. And when you walk into their company, it's interesting to see these people because they're wearing these what's called bunny suits. They're dressed from head to toe in white, like doctors, but even their hair and their faces are covered up because to make these tiny devices, they need an ultra-clean environment. Another company from Calgary that is interesting is Voodoo PC. They make personal computers for people, and for 3 years in a row, they've won the prestigious award of the ultimate gaming machine, competing head-to-head with companies like Dell and HP. And some things that make them interesting is when you receive this computer, it comes in a container that has a jungle-themed music, drumming sound to it when you open it. So I'm looking forward to ordering one and experiencing the whole Voodoo concept.
It sounds like this was rather a beastly experience between bunnies and a jungle theme. What's next on the agenda?
Well, first thing is all the companies in the book are going to be receiving the Cool Companies Award because they really deserve it, and I'd like to honor them. Next year there'll be another Cool Companies book, so we'll be updating the Edmonton and Calgary book for 2006 with some new companies as well. And then we'll be expanding the Cool Companies concepts to different cities. But what I'm really looking forward to is hearing about the cool opportunities readers are going to be finding in through the book and how it's going to impact their lives. The book has been selling really well, so there should be lots of really neat opportunities, and I can't wait to hear them.
Thank you very much, Claudia.
Thank you.
That was Claudia Sammer, president of Cool Companies, Inc. Her book, Cool Companies, Calgary and Edmonton 2005, is available at bookstores, through the internet, and it sells for $23.95. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the University of Lethbridge, Science Alberta Foundation, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatic Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.